Now, hey, do you have a minute? I want to have a one-on-one conversation with you about race and gender and sexual orientation and mistakes we might make when we talk about those things. Okay, your heart rate might have gone up a bit there. You might think, am I going to say something that offends lots of people? Is this going to be a painful, difficult conversation? Is Rob going to say something cringeworthy? If just thinking about these kind of talks makes you uncomfortable, you're not alone. It can be easier to not have these conversations at all. But hang on. Our next guests say it's important to talk about these topics, and they have a lot of advice to help have good conversations. They have a lot of experience and research to back it up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a difficult conversation with friends, coworkers, classmates, family, or others about issues related to race or gender, sexual orientation, other issues of identity? What went poorly? What went well? What do you wish you'd done differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow are professors at the New York University School of Law, where they run the Meltzer Center for Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging. Their new book is called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kenji, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kenji, I think, as I just said, sometimes the easiest path is to not talk about these issues of identity so much. A huge part of your book is making the case that, yeah, it is important. It's worth the effort. Convince people who might be skeptical.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the first case to be made is that silence is no longer viewed to be neutrality. I think silence in many quarters is viewed to be complicity and an unjust status quo. And so simply remaining on the sidelines is not an option, just for the kind of blowback that you might receive from individuals who need you in these conversations. And then in a more uplifting way, I think that we all have values as individuals who want to create a more inclusive society for all, to stand up for those values. And we're not going to be able to do that if we are so frozen in fear that we opt out of these conversations or run away from them.
And David, I think one response people might have, I'll throw me out there as an example. I'm white, male, and straight. And somebody in my position might say, if I have this conversation with somebody who doesn't meet one of those categories, I'm going to be blamed for something. I'm going to be the bad guy. I'm going to be made to feel shame. How do you try to assure people that it doesn't have to be that way?
Well, we specifically wrote this book to be shame-free. We don't like shaming approaches to these conversations. In fact, one of the core principles that we're trying to get across in our book is to shift people in emphasis away from cancel culture toward what we call coaching culture. That is, rather than just shaming and blaming people who make mistakes in these conversations, we really want to wrap our arms around people and give them practical tools for how to have these conversations more effectively, like a coach would, so that you don't get ostracized, but rather you're given the skills like how to apologize, how to disagree, how to build curiosity, resilience, all of the practical tools you need to have these conversations effectively.
Okay, Kenji, shame-free, but not necessarily easy. There can be some discomfort in these conversations, and you use the phrase in the book, the democratization of discomfort. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so there's a certain amount of discomfort that is kind of par for the course for these conversations. And I think one of the things that we have to realize is that if these conversations have seemed more comfortable, right, prior to the last, say, 5 or 10 years, it's not that the discomfort hasn't been there, it's that the discomfort has been entirely borne by the other party to the conversation. So that if I'm having a conversation about gender with a woman sort of 20 years ago, it might mean that the conversation is acutely uncomfortable for her, but totally comfortable for me. And one of the things that's changed in the last 20 years is that when we have those conversations, that woman might have higher expectations of what kinds of behavior and understanding she expects from me. And I might experience that in turn as a form of discomfort, because now the discomfort is being shared between us. She's not assuming the full burden of that, and it's more fairly distributed across the two of us. So oftentimes people come to us and they say, like, oh my gosh, like, why was that conversation so uncomfortable? It was like, you know, fingers on a chalkboard. I was like dying to get out of that room. And a response is to say, maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe the question isn't, why is this conversation so uncomfortable? But rather, why has it been so comfortable until now? And oftentimes the answer is because the other side, the non-dominant side of the conversation, has been bearing the brunt of that discomfort until this point.
David, if I'm criticized for anything, I'm human, a particular kind of human, I can get defensive. And my initial response isn't necessarily going to be great. And you two write that in these conversations about race and identity, when somebody's, you know, called on something they may have done wrong or that made somebody uncomfortable, their defensive reactions can be in a handful of categories: avoid, deflect, deny, attack. We may not have time to go into all of them in detail, but how do we check that initial response to, I don't know, to fight back or just run away from this conversation?
Yeah, as you say, you know, avoid, deflect, deny, and attack are the most common responses that we see. And you can think of avoid and deflect a little bit like flight in a fight or flight response. So you're running away from the conversation, whereas deny and attack are the fight mode. That's where you're standing in the conversation, but you're pushing back hard on the other person, and in some cases making it quite personal and attacking them. And so we think that the key skill, or one of the key skills to develop to overcome these ADDA behaviors, is resilience. So building the kind of emotional stamina and strength to be able to persist in these conversations despite the overwhelming discomfort that you may feel. And so one of the tools that we offer in the book is to give people the ability to adopt a growth mindset. It's very common in these conversations that when you make a mistake, you think about it as a reflection of your innate moral character. So that must mean I'm a terrible person, I'm a racist, I'm a sexist, what have you. What we want people to do instead is move to what the psychologist Carol Dweck calls a growth mindset, meaning that you respond to a mistake as an opportunity to learn. So if I make a mistake when I'm playing the piano, I don't think that makes me a terrible person. I just think I need to practice more to improve the next time. And we want to give people the tools to be able to take that same attitude of growth mindset into this arena of conversations about identity.
Talking to David Glasgow and Kenji Yoshino about their new book, Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you feel uncomfortable doing that, I totally understand. But if you have an anecdote to share, a question for our guest, we would love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kenji, something David just said reminded me of an anecdote later in your book when you're talking about, you know, when you see somebody else, maybe a family member or someone saying something. The example is, I think it was a woman. Her uncle said something about, I think, Mexican immigrants, a disparaging remark. Her approach was really interesting. It wasn't, why would you say that? It was, I know you're a good person. I know you would like run into a burning building and save someone. You wouldn't ask about their immigration status. Can you talk about that kind of approach to checking someone on that?
Yes, it's actually a beautiful connection that you're drawing there, because one might say, okay, I can have all the growth mindset in the world, but I'm still going to be afraid, because even if I'm compassionate towards myself when I make a mistake, other people might not be compassionate right. towards me, and they might cancel me. And oftentimes that's what we're really afraid of. So we make a huge point in the book about saying that part of being a good ally in these conversations is being an ally, not just to the person who's been harmed, but also to the source of non-inclusive behavior. And what we mean by that is that when somebody messes up, you know, our first instinct might be to pile onto that person, but we have to understand that that's all of us. It's not a question of whether we're going to make a mistake. It's a question of when we will make that mistake. And so it behooves us to be compassionate and kind and to help people of goodwill grow past the mistakes that we're making. So it's really the flip side of the growth mindset that David was talking about. The glorious story that you mentioned comes from the wonderful Loretta Ross, a scholar up at Smith, who talks about how we need to stop calling people out and start calling people in. And so what she says to the uncle who makes this opprobrious comment about immigrants is to actually affirm him as a person, saying, I know you, Uncle Frank. I know you're an incredible human being. If there was a burning building, you would rush in to save it, and you wouldn't care if the person in that building was gay or an immigrant or what have you. So please help me reconcile the incredibly loving, wonderful Uncle Frank, whom I know you to be, with the words that just came out of your mouth. And that, we think, is a wonderful way to approach somebody, because it's not just like hate the sin, not the sinner. It's affirm the person, right? You know, bring the person back into it and say, you know, you're a wonderful human being. Help me understand how that conduct or that comment was consistent, right, with the ideals that I know that that human being has.
We're talking to Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow about their new book. It's called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this kind of conversation maybe around a family dinner table in a workplace diversity training? What went well, do you think? What was painful? Painful in a good way or just bad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow about their new book, Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. A lot of practical advice for having difficult, potentially difficult conversations. If you're willing to share an experience or a question, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you need some advice on how to have this kind of conversation and how to approach it. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, we've heard a few of your principles on, you know, how to have good, productive conversations. I want to check out another one now, cultivate curiosity. How do we do that and how do we use it to benefit ourselves when we're talking about these issues of identity?
So we point out in our chapter on curiosity that oftentimes when we show up to these conversations from the more dominant group side, so as a white person, if I'm entering a conversation about race, or as someone who doesn't have a disability, if I'm entering a conversation about disability, we often enter those conversations where with a lot of knowledge that we lack. So if I'm speaking with someone who uses a wheelchair, I won't know necessarily about where the curb cuts and ramps are in my neighborhood or what kinds of biases or barriers that people with disabilities encounter as they go about their lives. Whereas the person that I'm speaking with often will know that information or at least know it a lot better than I will. And so we think it's really important for people like me in that conversation to be humble as we enter those conversations about the areas where we lack knowledge and to listen generously to the perspective of the person that we're speaking to and respect the extra knowledge that that person likely brings into the conversation. And so a couple of techniques for doing that. One is just do some research. I mean, you're never going to be able to fully understand what it's like to belong to a different social group than your own, but you can do a lot of ordinary research, like listening to podcasts or reading books or reading articles about the experience of people from other groups. And then when you're actually in a conversation with someone, we think it's really important to share your own perspective in the conversation tentatively and listen generously to the other person. So when you're sharing your own perspective, rather than making statements of definitive fact as though you know everything there is to know, you might instead use I statements. So say things like, I wonder, I feel, I think, and even explicitly say to the person that you're offering your perspective with that humility. So you might say, this is a draft, so please edit it, things like that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Celia is with us in Madison. Celia, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I appreciate you and your speakers very much. I used to teach communications as a consultant, and I agree 100% with what they're saying, that if somebody has said something or acted out in some way, discuss a behavior or the words as soon as possible so you don't drift into you're a bad person. And since we're only supposed to be facilitators, we couldn't tell people what to do. So what we finally fell back on was asking the person, well, what would you say are the consequences of what you just did or said? So they teach themselves.
Celia, interesting. Thanks for sharing that experience. Kenji, the two of you work a lot in the business world. What do you think of Celia's approach?
I really love it. And I really appreciate the call as well. You know, one of the things that this highlights is the distinction between intent and impact that we often focus on. So, you know, oftentimes when we're having these conversations and someone calls us out or tries to call us in on something, we immediately deflect to go back to our earlier conversation. To our good intentions, right? And so we channel switch and we say, well, my intent was really good, and so therefore you should give me a pass. And one of the things that, like Celia, we urge people to do is to focus not on their own intent, but focus on the impact that the action or the comment might have had on the other person. Because if you focus on impact, you know, that's much more likely to get at the nub of what is bothering the other person. I can have all the good intent in the world and have stepped on your foot by accident, you know, but it doesn't take away any of the pain that I've caused. And so keeping the frame steadily on the consequences of the actions, on the impact of the action rather than your own intent, is a really good practice.
Celia, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. David, Celia brings up a situation that is, I guess, reactive. Something has happened. We're dealing with it now. Is there a way for a business or school or whatever institution is to create, I don't know, I guess an environment where you can avoid some of those incidents or have that framework for dealing with them from the get-go?
Absolutely. And we think that a really critical concept in this area is called allyship, which may be familiar to some of your listeners, which is the idea that all of us, no matter what demographic group we belong to, have a role to play to build that kind of inclusive culture. And we have worked with a lot of organizations that have really tried to embed that concept of allyship into their organization through education, research, training, and the way that they talk about diversity and inclusion issues inside their organizations. Because the idea behind allyship is a really simple one, which is that when you witness, you know, non-inclusive behavior, or even before witnessing non-inclusive behavior, you can show up to these conversations enacting a lot of the principles that we describe in the book by displaying resilience and curiosity, by disagreeing respectfully, by apologizing authentically. And by doing that at the outset, we hope that a lot of the kinds of incidents that we've been describing can be avoided if people have adopted those principles at the outset.
Talking to David Glasgow and Kenji Yoshino about their new book. It's called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Kenji, there'll be a portion of the audience listening who hears the words identity and diversity has a framework on that where that says, yeah, I'm going to tune out now. This is an attack on people who are white or male, or the list goes on. And that's, we're seeing that in the political world, certainly. What would you say to reach out to them and try to bring them into the conversation?
I would say that, you know, there are people who, you know, are just ideologically opposed to the project of a more inclusive society. And that those individuals should have their opinions respected, but also should kind of be left alone. So one of our great colleagues, Dolly Chug here at NYU, a psychologist, says D&I, like many other things, diversity inclusion, that is, obeys the 20-60-20 rule, where 20% are just unbelievably, you know, for it, they're champions, 20% are ideologically opposed to it. And then the most people are in that 60% in the movable middle. So I think when people sort of have this allergy to diversity and inclusion, you first need to figure out where they sit, whether they're in the kind of oppose 20%, in which case just leave them alone. They're entitled to their opinion. They're not going to move any more than I'm going to move from my commitments to diversity and inclusion. But if you're talking to that middle 60%, it's really important to meet the concerns of that middle 60%, because oftentimes what I feel like is that I'm standing at one end of a room and say, like, Ron DeSantis or Sarah Huckabee Sanders come to mind as people who have recently come out against diversity and inclusion initiatives. We're standing at the other end of the room. And so we're, you know, totally at loggerheads. We're not going to persuade each other, but we're talking to the people in the middle of the room and trying to get them to come to our side. And what I would say to the person who's in the middle, who's undecided about how they feel about diversity and inclusion issues, is, can you actually allow us to challenge ourselves as the people who want to convince you that D&I has a great value proposition in terms of creating a more equitable, a more just, a more inclusive society, to sort of change tacks? Because I think too often, again, we've been talking to you in terms of this fear-based rhetoric of, if you make one mistake, you'll get canceled. And of course, the more we talk about canceling people or hurting people when they make, you know, genuine good faith mistakes, the more the other side looks more attractive, because the other side is saying, say whatever you want. And then if you disagree, if other people disagree with you, then you can just call them crazy and denigrate them. So what we want to say instead, again, going back to the point about moving from cancel culture to coaching culture, is we want to put an arm around the people in the middle and to say, you have these ideals that are really worth fighting for, of a more inclusive, egalitarian society. We are a more diverse society, so these conversations are, you know, inescapable. But what we want to do for you is not to shame you. We want to hold you to very, very high standards, right? But we're not going to shame you in reaching them. We're going to actually give you all the support that you need, and we're going to give you actual skills, which cancel culture emphatically does not, in order to have these conversations so that you can have guardrails, right, around you, so that the degree to which you'll fail or your likelihood of success right, change, right? Your degree of failure is going to be much smaller. Your likelihood of success is going to be much greater. And I think that one of the mistakes that people in the D&I community have made with the best of intentions is to lean into the kind of punitive aspects of diversity and inclusion and not lean into the kind of more joyful, skill-based, you know, this is about human flourishing aspects of diversity and inclusion.
And David, with just a half a minute, one piece of advice you give in the book, useful to all of us, a tip for making a good apology.
Yeah, so we think apologies are actually fairly simple because they follow the four R's of recognition, responsibility, remorse, and redress. So first, recognize the harm. Second, take responsibility for causing the harm. Third, show remorse. So be sincere in your expression of contrition. And then fourth, give some redress. So actually take action to back up your words so that it's not just all talk.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Kenji, thanks for being with us today.
What a great conversation. Thank you.
I've been talking to Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow. Their new book is called Say the Right Thing: How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice.